Everybody, it's me, Nagin Farsad, and normally I'm a comedian and the host of the political comedy podcast Fake the Nation, but today I am your host here at Midday, and I'm really excited for this panel that we cooked up for you. Last Thursday, President Trump proposed sweeping changes to immigration law that could affect millions of people living and working in the United States. The proposal requests permanent protections for people who were brought to the United States illegally as children, including those in the DACA program. But the proposal also calls for $25 billion for a border wall, and it places major restrictions on family-based migration. Many of us are immigrants, or the children and grandchildren of immigrants. So what do we make of these proposals, and how do policies like these affect our notion of the American dream? Joining us today to discuss this are Stephanie Butnick, deputy editor of Tablet Magazine and the host of the podcast Unorthodox, comedian, lawyer, writer, and radio host Dino Vidala, and comedian, writer, and actor Jordan Carlos. I'm so happy that you guys are on the show today. Hi, guys.
Hello.
So let's start with like the big philosophical question. What does the American dream mean to each of you? Jordan.
Jump in. White picket fence, sizable house, 2.5 children, a half child, which is great.
Right.
Just that what I see in the movies, what I was told that I would get at the end, I don't know if I worked really hard. A cozy life, basically.
Right.
You know, success.
Stephanie, right? Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, the white picket fence is a little bit ironic, but at the same time, it is what you sort of want. You know, though the idea of like ending up in the suburbs is to me very cringeworthy, but it's sort of, you want that. You want what they told you you could have, basically. And I don't know who they are, but they is. But, you know, that's just sort of what we were raised with, this idea that your parents work hard, and then they create a good life for you, and then you work hard and you create this good, like that everyone gets a better shot than the generation.
Than the predecessors.
The previous generation. Yeah.
So Dean, was it that you were supposed to do better than your parents?
I think so. Can I just first say, you have the whole WNYC toned down so well, Nagin. Like, you really just, it wasn't the Nagin for some, I know, it's very
I don't know what you mean.
Exactly. It's very like, now get a tote bag. Pledge right now. That's why, do you have tote bag? To me, the American dream, though, is beyond the land of the United States of America. I think it represents something special. I mean, my Palestinian father came to America because there was a dream that went transcended our borders, like a beacon of hope. And my Sicilian grandparents, the same thing. So to me, the American dream is not just me doing well, frankly. It's that we're going to provide a safe haven for those in other countries and other places who need a place they can grow up in, and hopefully they can dream, not cruelly, but truly dream of a better life. And that's what I think the American dream is.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Dean, because I actually had the same definition that, you know, that Jordan and Stephanie had, which is basically the suburbs, the white picket fence, the like material goods, right? Yes,
right.
Some sort of a large car in the driveway.
Can I leave now? This is ridiculous. I'm going to ganged up. I didn't know it was that kind of show.
I had the same feelings about it, but I was reading up on this. So the term came out about in the 1930s in a book called The Epic of America by James Truslow Adams. And in that book, it was more about values like freedom, mutual respect, and equality of opportunity. And it wasn't necessarily defined in these more kind of stricter material confines, right? And I think that's interesting because it's actually... It segues very nicely into a conversation about immigration. But what do you guys think about the American dream kind of returning to its original definition of having to do with values as opposed to with gains?
I think within those gains, though, are the implicit values, right? What we're saying is access to those things. Like, for instance, African Americans were redlined for so long, so we couldn't buy homes or get mortgages or things like that. I hope that cleans up what I said before. I think that's what I mean. It's like my kids get into a good school or a college, you know, whereas before we didn't have that. And of course, freedom for all. Yes, that's a great American value. That is the American dream. But, being African American, I can, you know, just going generations back, that wasn't the case. So it's like for us at least, it's all about like bootstrapping and, like, you know, working your way up. Our, you know, our migration was a little different.
Right. So, I don't know what you mean.
do you have time? All right.
I mean, Jordan Carlos, by the way, is African American. I just want to point that out.
But there's also, there was, like, migration within migration, right? You had the Great Migration. So we came up from the South to the North to work in factories and things like that. So, you know, we are migrants within the 20th century as well as the 19th century, you know, and I just feel like, I don't know, that freedom, of course, is understated, or it's just implied in being like African American. I didn't want you to think that it's like all I wanted was a nice, like, you know, row house or something like that, and I'd be set. You know?
So far you have an A- so far on this panel, okay. Jordan. Great. You're doing okay.
All right,
Stephanie. To what extent do you think immigration is part of the American story today? Like, how much do we embrace immigration when it comes to the American dream?
Well, to me, there's literally nothing more American than taking the American dream as meaning, like, values and ethics and turning it into something consumerism, by the way. Right. Like, and you'll buy this house, you will get this purebred dog and this brand of car.
Right.
But to me, being American means that you understand that everyone has a right to be here just the way you do. You know, my grandparents came to the United States after the Holocaust with literally nothing, with no family, and rebuilt. And to me, that is what America is. It's this land of promise, and it doesn't necessarily mean you need the house or the car. It's just this idea that everyone is allowed to start over. Everyone is allowed to have the chance for even just the opportunity to be here and to do what it is, you know, what you want with that. I mean, there's just something to be an American and say, you know, actually, immigration isn't important to us. You know, we don't want to have people come in. It's like, where do you think this country came from? I mean,
right.
We were not the first people here.
Dean, you have that joke that sometimes people think Jesus was born in Nebraska.
Well, no, that's because they want to ban Sharia law. They call it foreign law, the guys on the right, because of them. Jesus was born in Iowa. Yeah, he was. He was wrapped in a pickup truck and driven home in a pickup truck while Toby Keith music was playing. Of course he was.
But what are your thoughts on the proposal, the Trump, Donnie's new proposal?
It's horrible. But, you know, I wrote an article for Daily Beast about immigration. And I went back and I found a quote from George Washington. Nobody quotes George Washington except for the cherry tree. Except for that, like, I will not lie. He had a statement on immigration. And he said, "The United States should be open to receive not only the opulent and respected stranger, but the oppressed and persecuted of all nations and religions." That was the first president, one of the founding fathers, saying the vision, the DNA of this nation was to accept people. And the Donald Trump plan, the DACA thing is it's cruel in the way he's played a game. The media's lost the fact that Donald Trump unilaterally ended DACA in September. It's now we have a crisis. He created it, right?
Right.
But now he wants to end family unification. Like, my family wouldn't be here. And that's the simple thing of, like, you come and you bring your brother or your sister over. That's a radical change in our system that we've had for decades, since 1965. So I think it's horrible. I think it's destroying the American story. Not the American, but it ends the next chapter, which is you come over and you bring over your brother or your sisters. They too can share in what is hopefully a better life and more opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, one of the arguments is, and I have to tell you guys, because again, you three may or may not know this about me, but everybody listening knows I'm an Iranian American Muslim lady, and
and and that's the end of the interview.
Check, please. We gotta go. No one told me that.
So my parents immigrated from Iran, and they. The thing about chain migration, which has been turned into this ugly word, which we refer to as family reunification. But the thing about chain migration is that it's not actually real. Chain migration suggests that it's that, like, you know, my aunt's sister's dentist made it over because we were able to bring everybody or whatever. And then, you know, a lot of people are saying that
my people came by chain migration.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really want to get into it, but go ahead.
By the way, I'm speaking to Jordan Carlos, Stephanie Butnick, and Dean Obidala, and we are talking about immigration and the American dream. But the thing about chain migration is that it's largely a myth. I mean, I can tell you from personal experience that it takes years. I mean, years to get a family member over here. We managed to get, I mean, I think over a decade in the case of one of my aunts who made it over. And which is why 97% of my family is still in Iran. I don't have the aunts and the uncles, all these people that President Trump thinks might be coming over through chain migration. They're not here. We were unable to get them over here because the backlog in the system. By the way, the average wait time in the late 80s was 6 to 12 years to get into the country. And that number is now worse. Right now, the government is dealing with sibling visas for Chinese families that were filed in 2004. Wow. So the idea that chain migration is a huge issue is physically impossible because of the actual time it takes.
Well, that seems like reality getting in the way of feelings, right? Like if you feel like they're invading, then you don't really want to deal with those kind of numbers, correct? So,
right.
You know, if you that's what Donald Trump and, you know, the right does is they just make it feel like they're coming. They're coming and we have to do something about it, right? So right. I think that you can toss out as many stats as you'd like, but it feels as though we need to change, the needle has to change as far as perception is concerned. If the perception remains what it is and they build upon it all the more, that the borders need to be solidified, that people are pouring over one way or the other, that walls can't be scaled by, say, planes, which is usually what people take to get into the country, then these great walls will be built. I think it's up to $25 billion, as you said. It's up from $18 billion previously, the price. I don't know what happened. Did they add a pool or a moat or something? I have no idea.
It's on eBay. It's being bid up a lot. Right?
It's an infinity wall. Like, you tell me.
Dean,
yes.
Can you tell? So we heard a little bit from Jordan and Stephanie about their family's histories. Mm-hmm. What is your family history and how does it play into your feelings about all of this?
Well, I mean, it plays into, I'm here because of immigration and it's very immediate in my family. I mean, my dad came here. He was born in what was then Palestine, 1930s, and now it's the West Bank. And he came here in 1956. Hmm. He became a cook at the U.S. Embassy in Jordan. Why he picked there, I don't know. His English was limited. He didn't even have a high school education, but he knew America represented something better. So he got a job as a cook at the Jordan Embassy and became friends there and got sponsored and then made it to New Jersey. The dream comes true. And then he became a cook here and then brought his brother over. And on my mom's side, my Sicilian grandparents wanted to come here for a better life. And they came, you know, a generation before that. And interesting, both sides of my family had to deal with bigotry. My father's Palestinian Muslim and they've had to deal with it. And my Sicilian Catholic ancestors had to deal with bigotry. But one quick thing about chain migration, because I mentioned in my article, and I also did more research over the weekend. The term chain migration comes from academia, but in reality, it came into use now to end it from white supremacists. And when I did research, you see it in the early 2000s, the American Renaissance, which is a white supremacist publication, Jared Taylor, going against chain migration, and it seeped from there. And then they found Donald Trump, the white supremacist hope, who then championed an idea that truly, I'm not even exaggerating, comes out of white supremacy. This has been their dream to end chain migration and the diversity visa program over and over and over. And they finally found a guy who will do that for them.
Yeah, that's interesting because I don't remember chain migration being in heavy use before like recent months. Mm-hmm. And that's not in my imagination.
And Media Matters did a great study. The term chain migration was only used maybe once or twice, I'm not kidding, on Fox News 2015 or 16, last year over 200 times. That's because Donald Trump is marketing that and they're talking about chain migration. It literally is a white supremacist dream to stop the browning of America. And those are the articles that title it and that's what they're about.
Yeah. Well, we are going to take a quick break. I'm Nagin Farsad, and I'm speaking with Stephanie Butnick, host of the podcast Unorthodox, radio host and writer Dean Obidala, and comedian Jordan Carlos about how to fight for immigration rights in the age of Trump. Later on in the show, Kristen Wong talks about how to be straightforward and direct with people in your professional and personal life, plus pastry chef Lisa Vega on the art of making chocolate. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. Oh, hey, we're back. I'm Nagin Farsad, and I'm speaking with Stephanie Butnick, host of the podcast Unorthodox, radio host and writer Dino Bidala and comedian Jordan Carlos about how to fight for immigration rights in the age of Trump. Let's get into the nitty-gritty of this bill, though, of the proposal that's being offered. The White House wants to see a bill offering permanent protection for people in the expiring deferred action for childhood arrivals, the DACA program. But in its exchange, it wants a measure to include $25 billion for a border wall and an end to chain migration that we were talking about and an end to the visa lottery program. Is Trump sending mixed signals? Like, what do we conclude from this proposal, Jordan?
Ransom. It's a ransom note. Mm. You know, it's like, yes, you'll let the Dreamers, who, I mean, a majority of people believe have the moral right to stay, you know, within the country because they had no choice in the matter. They were brought here and they do nothing but contribute. They have jobs. They pay taxes. But, you know, and so that's why Donald Trump's like, I love the Dreamers. I love them. Right. But at the same time, he wants his border wall. He wants to deliver on that campaign promise. And that's what he's doing. Right. He sees an angle. He sees an opportunity and he's using them as a poker chip.
But Stephanie, is there a big deal with giving him this border wall? I mean, compromise is compromise. If we want to reach some sort of bipartisan deal, it would probably have to include this main campaign promise that he made.
It just feels like we're selling out in a lot of ways. Like, I understand how politics works, and I understand that you need to make negotiations. But to me, it's buying into that campaign promise, which so many people have such a big problem with. And I get that Donald Trump can say, like, you know, oh, the Dreamers, like, everyone understands that they were kids. And that to me is almost like it's a bridge too far for him and for most even people on the right. But to me, I just feel the idea that this wall could actually happen symbolizes, I think, a new era in America and in American politics, and to me is sort of unimaginable to a lot of people.
But okay, so the wall maybe doesn't look like, you know, a poured concrete wall that goes into the sky forever. We're not necessarily talking about the Great Wall of China here.
Right.
So does that make a difference? Like, what does he really?
The campaign promise was Mexico was going to pay for this. By the way, we were not going to pay for this, and he's failed at getting Mexico. So now because of his failure, we have to pay for it. That's ridiculous. Look, I think Democrats, everything I've seen, and even I've had members of Congress on my show, have said, we don't mind paying more for border security, like more agents. Nobody cares. Drones and, you know, some kind of like electronic fencing. But the actual wall is ridiculous to people. Again, the Dreamer program was ended by one person, Donald J. Trump. That's who ended it. And on his campaign trail, he said about the Dreamer kids, what about our kids' dreams? Like, he made it clear he was not for the Dreamer kids.
Right.
Our kids' dreams are code for white kids' dreams. Mm-hmm. Why do we have to talk about their dreams? Donald Trump ends the program. Now he wants to be the white savior to this whole thing. It's absolutely ridiculous to me. But if the Democrats have to give in on some border money, that's different. You know, giving more money for more border agents, more drones, I don't think anyone would mind about that. It's interesting, though, he's expanded the number from 800,000 Dreamers that are part of DACA to 1.8 million. And these other million did not qualify for DACA for whatever reason. And I'm not sure the right's going to go along with that, to be honest with you, because we don't know. Because to DACA, you cannot have a criminal conviction. You can have a felony. Mm-hmm. We don't know why the other million, do some of them have felonies? Do they not go to school? I mean, that's part of DACA. You had to go to school or serve in the military. Mm-hmm. Like, how? And background checks, none of that applies. I'm kind of stunned that he's expanded that in a way. It almost seems like a poison pill for the right, and I'm not sure what his real game is.
I don't know if it's a poison pill so much as it's a bargaining chip. You know, he wants to make a deal. He calls himself the great deal maker, so he just, this is a deal that you can't turn down. Whereas before it was 800,000, now it's 1.8 million. You know, like, that's a whole other a million people. Like, come on, Dems, go along with it. Give me my wall. My big, beautiful wall with a big, beautiful door. You know?
Right.
Yeah. Like,
well, one of the arguments that seems to kind of play decently well with American audiences is the idea that terrorists enter the United States through some of these, so either through the border, but more through the chain migration. He points to one case for evidence. There's a 27-year-old man in New York City subway with a bomb in December who entered the country in 2011 because he was sponsored by a relative. I mean, how would you counter that argument?
I would say that the ADL released a report that said in 2017, the largest number of terrorist acts were done by white supremacists. That is a fact. That there actually is not this influx of terrorist immigrants coming in. If we're going to use the terrorism and violence and that argument doesn't play, because in reality, and what Donald Trump will actually never admit, is that there's a lot of there is a problem here, but it's because of a different group of people.
Right. There's a pathology like blind spot, right? So, like, you know, if someone commits an act, like in Kentucky, I believe there was a school shooting a couple days ago wherein two children were killed and a number, I think it was 19 people were injured. But like, some of the first comments and reactions you get are, we got to do something about the mentally ill, you know? So not to say that people who like the bomber in the subway, wasn't he also mentally ill? I mean, right. Like, he couldn't be mentally
Muslims,
ill.
Muslims, we can't be mentally ill.
You can't
We're not possible, right, Nagin? Everything we do is calculated and sinister.
Nothing. Really?
Yes, we can't be.
Are you inscrutable?
We are unbelievable.
That's amazing.
Everything we do is calculated. It's not. We can never be mentally ill, apparently, at least in the media and the world
that
of Donald
Trump.
That
sounds exhausting.
Really?
It is. Oh, my God.
It's a
I
lot
need
of
therapy
responsibility
so badly.
For
I can't
Muslims,
go to therapy either. It's part
tell you
of
that much.
Look at Donald. But look at Donald. To your point, the ADL report, and I cited in my article, is exactly the point. 34 people killed by extremists last year, 18 by white supremacists. Donald Trump has not tried to end any program mm-hmm. over those, but literally for one person, for the visa diversity program, which he mentioned, the guy who drove on the West Side Highway and committed a terrorist attack, and the guy, the failed subway bomber here, he wants to end programs that have been around for decades, completely scrap them, but no sweeping changes when it comes to white supremacists or for mass shootings. So the credibility is gone. Again, this goes, forget, there's no good faith public policy reason for this. It's purely bigotry
right.
turned into policy. And I wish the people on the left would start advocating that and articulating that. This is a white supremacist policy championed now by the president of the United States.
That's what I like to do in the comedy clubs, at least.
That's
I mean, you like to, you mean people, you get, you know, whenever I'm at the Cellar or anything like that, you know, it's I play the Cellar, guys.
what?
It's really
club brag.
It's really important, I think. You know, you get to see hundreds, if not, you know, upon thousands of people every month come through the doors, and then you get to, you know, give your message on migration. Like, for me, I do a bit about apple picking and how, like, for some people, it's like a fun, you know, Sunday afternoon. And for other people, it's a way of life. You know what I'm saying? Like, and so, like, I do a bit, like, where my now wife on our third date was like, hey, do you want to go apple picking with me? And I was like, well, you know, I'm black. We picked everything we're going to pick. But I'll do it. We don't play peasant for funsies. To illuminate in people's heads that, oh, this is just like cosplay. And that if, you know, we really got rid of the people that actually do these jobs, this wouldn't be you'd have to find something else to fill your time on Sunday. You know, like, this is a reality. And I don't think that people really understand how much people that come to this country for a better life, you know, add to the economy and subsidize their lives, right? So that, you know, I mean, even simple things like apples, the price would raise. And, like, you know, working at Purdue factories and working at like dairies in the Midwest. There's an article in the New York Times Magazine about how people voted for Trump. These dairy farmers voted for Trump, and now they're about to lose their workforce. You know, they're just like,
right.
Like, people didn't, you know, think about the ramifications. That's at least that's what I can do as a comedian. You know, I mean, you're asking how to fight, and that's the fight I make. I love to make the crowd a little a little uncomfortable.
Right.
And then
I've seen your act. You make them very uncomfortable. You're
We're here with three people that make everybody uncomfortable. You guys, it's Jordan Carlos, the comedian Stephanie Butnick of Unorthodox, and Dean Ovidala, a comedian and writer. Well, where's your position on what's your position on the lottery system? I mean, here's one thing that President Trump always talks about is moving more towards a merit-based immigration system. Where does on the face of it, saying something like that sounds kind of reasonable, no?
It's already merit-based, though. Mm. It's already merit-based. Don't they have to go through like 10 different
agencies?
Vetting. There's vetting.
There's extreme vetting. Do you want to?
I think it's the same with using the word chain migration. It flattens the issue, and mm-hmm. it sort of says, okay, you're here, now your brother's going to come, and your sister's going to come, and her, as you said, dentist is going to come. and it just sort of elides the fact that there is a huge vetting process. There's the backlog, and the idea that you can just, like, grab someone and bring them over, and to me, that's why the idea, like, merit-based, like, oh, you do a good job, you know, in Norway, you can come here. But that's actually not – how any of this works. And I feel like there's a way in which what Donald Trump does is he's selling this to people. And there's a way in which there's we've lost the nuance of what actually of how complicated immigration is and how actually hard it is to get here.
I think to me, the fight has to be more on family unification than on the Democrats are going to give in. They're going to give in on that 50,000 people a year. And it's sort of a lottery, but you have to go through background checks. You have to be like, it's not like they pick the worst, as Trump says, is actually the opposite of that.
No, because you still go through significant vetting, even if you do win the lottery. So I've heard, you know, multiple stories of
Trump's
people winning the lottery and then still not being able to come in.
Well, that ultimately is merit-based.
Yeah.
It's a different merit-based than they want. The way they want it to be, really, you have to look like you're from Norway. That's the merit. Like, you have to have a, they're going to have a sign up at the Port Authority, I think at Customs, like, picture the White House. And underneath it says you have to be this white to get in the country, and that's the entire merit based
But why would people from Norway want to come here when they have like a better standard of living? It's a step down.
But he doesn't. But that's just
don't know. Healthcare seems overrated. No,
they seem happy too, don't they?
They do. They do.
I hate them for that.
Well, here's something that may that I'm curious to hear your thoughts on. The Trump administration has basically been fighting all year to get a travel ban imposed on immigrants from Muslim majority countries. Mm-hmm. Given what we know about the people immigrating to the United States, fleeing war in Syria and elsewhere, what's the ban is going into effect? What's the reasoning behind the ban?
I mean, it's all part and parcel of the same thing. This is a man who campaigned saying, I want a total complete shutdown of Muslims, and the crowd went crazy. And and the Republican base loved it. And 65% of GOP primary voters support that. A total ban on Muslims, not just on isolated countries. You're giving red meat to a bigoted base. Donald Trump is the great white supremacist hope. And he's earned that title, in my view. He's done everything. Banning Muslims is the bigotry that the GOP has been talking about for years, demonizing us, especially you. A lot of Nagin and some of
me. Specifically.
And so that's part and parcel. This whole, the one common denominator of this is banning immigrants, banning Muslims. It comes from a place of demographic change and scaring people who, they're not going to burn a cross on someone's lawn, but they really are fearful of whites, the white being value being diluted in this country. And they are white supremacists at their essence.
Well, Stephanie, do you think Trump's efforts to ban Muslim immigrants are any different from, let's say, America's rejection of Jews fleeing Nazi Germany?
Well, I think one of the sort of the metaphors that comes up a lot is the St. Louis. And that was the boat that came from Nazi Germany. It was headed for Cuba, where everyone had papers to then hopefully get into the United States. And then once it docked in Havana, I think about like 12 or 20 people got off the boat of 900 people. And then, of course, they were super close to Florida and everyone was like telegraphing people trying to, whatever they did back then, trying to get in the country. And they were sort of roundly rejected. And it's very obvious what happened. I mean, that's a very stark example, right? It's really easy to say there was a ship of people who were fleeing complete danger and the United States just turned them away. There are also a ton of other examples of this happening over the years. And I think if you look at what's going on in Syria, like, it's not like there are refugees flooding our doors right now. It's still really, really, really difficult to get here. And I work at Tablet, which is a Jewish magazine. I think the Jewish community is especially attuned to this idea that when you shut out people based on where they're coming from, it's nothing good happens, especially when you know that there's a bad situation where they're coming from. It just seems silly to not learn from history in that way.
So just bringing this back a little bit to the American dream, in her recent column for the New York Times, Kashana Cowley pointed out that Americans still believe in the promise of the American dream. She actually cited a survey from last August which found that 36% of American adults believe their family has achieved the American dream, which is defined as freedom of choice in how to live, a good family life, and retiring comfortably. Those are the categories. An additional 46% believe they are on their way to achieving it. Given what you guys have described, which has been a rather bleak reaction to this new proposal and to what's happening. Were these numbers surprising to you?
These numbers are surprising to me a bit. But then again, I used to work in advertising for a long time. So the American dream is a great It's a great slogan. It's a great campaign. It's almost as good as America Runs on Dunkin', because no one runs anywhere on donuts. you might roll yourself to dialysis, but that's about it. But we love a good slogan, and we think that it could be us someday. That's why we play the lottery, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. That's why we're sold, because we never want to say that we're poor. We're just millionaires in waiting, you know? So that, I think, not only keeps Americans happy about the American dream, but then also creates like this like beacon for those coming from foreign shores. It's like, oh my gosh, we could make it, you know? All you have to do is just be in debt up to your eyeballs. I think people have to rejigger the American dream. I mean, you guys jump in, but like, I feel like you have to rejigger what it looks like, but there's a possibility that there's a high possibility that you can have a good life. These numbers are bonkers to me, but go ahead.
Well, President Trump is going to be doing his State of the Union address tomorrow night.
Am I allowed to boo?
Impartial.
We shall be respectfully watching the State of the Union address tomorrow night. What do you guys expect? Any predictions?
Well, fireworks.
It's funny because I was watching the Grammys last night. And two times last night, the poet Emma Lazarus was mentioned, and she was quoted, and she was the poet who wrote the New Colossus, which is which is what's inscribed on the Statue of Liberty. And to me, that was, I mean, speaking of primetime TV that I will definitely be watching, that was so inspiring. One of the people who quoted it was Camila Cabello, who is a Grammy nominated pop star. And this idea that young people are actually, like, the people know who Emma Lazarus is, that gave me hope. But I think the State of the Union, we'll see, right? We always want to go in with this idea, like, this is the moment that Trump became president. Like, we are still sort of holding out hope that he will assume presidential behavior. But look, I think what we all know is, like, the ratings are going to be really important to him. I don't know, like, you know, if you... The inauguration, I think, was the last example of something like this, where we said, okay, now's the chance. Just lead us, unite our country. And that obviously didn't happen then. So I think people are sort of like watching a train wreck, like I will be watching.
But isn't that part of the dream, that you hold out hope, right? Based on nothing, that it will get better.
But with
America.
I think if you polled immigrants or children of immigrants who live here, do they think they fulfill the American dream, or do they have it? I think the numbers would be so much higher. Because I still have a sense of appreciation that this country let my father, mm-hmm. my grandparents in. So I feel like I'm living the American dream because I am the manifestation of it, oddly enough. If Palestinian Muslim marries a Sicilian Catholic woman and no holy wars, we just had a family and it was no big deal. That is America. This idea of Trump, I don't care if he reads Obama's last State of the Union. He's still a bigot and a racist and he's sexist. Yeah. There's nothing at this point this man can say to change anything. And we, as progressives, we're never going to forgive. I hope we're not going to forgive him and never forget and not let him normalize. I'm so angry at the pundits going, well, if he gives a good speech, maybe it's finally the pivot. I'm like, there's no pivot. He can read anything. The man is, as Maya Angelou said, you have to believe them. When they first show you who they are, believe who they are.
You believe it, yeah.
This is, Donald Trump is the guy from the campaign, the bigot and the racist who shamed victims of sexual assault, calling them liars. He's despicable.
Well, yes. I mean, I agree. And like, that is, like I said before, part of this kind of like people deluding themselves and lying to themselves that maybe he will change and become presidential. And I don't know, he'll like shed some skin or something like that. And the real president will expose himself.
I think it's pundits who see that more than us.
Yeah. Yeah, perhaps. But that's a 24-hour news cycle. Yeah.
Well, we shall see what happens tomorrow.
Can we stay for the pastry chef? Is that possible? There's a pastry chef and some chocolate involved.
That is
my joy
alone.
I'm like, I was in the wrong segment. Why could I do this?
Well, you guys, I'm Nagin Farsad. I've been speaking with Stephanie Butnick, host of the podcast Unorthodox, radio host and writer Dino Bidala, and comedian Jordan Carlos about how to fight for immigration rights in the age of Trump. Please do yourselves a favor and look for these fine people online and follow their good works. Thank you so much for joining me today, you guys. Coming up, we have Kristen Wong discussing her recent article for The Cut, A Beginner's Guide to Being Blunt. And later, we look at the epidemic of rape and assault in prisons across the country. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break.